The Undercover Capes Podcast Network proudly presents a series all about the amazing people behind the titles and characters we love. Welcome to Creator Spotlight.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Outside the Panels. Joining me today is an indie writer of renown. The writer of such books like Sync and Oxymoron, The Loveliest Nightmare. I'm joined by the writer of IDW's future hit due to hit stars in August, John Lees. John, how's it going?
Oh, thank you very much for the very nice introduction, and I admire your optimism about the future hit that is Mountainhead. We'll make it be. Thank you very much for the welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Good, excellent. I think it's going to be a future hit. I've had the privilege of reviewing the book for our sister site, Comic Crusaders. So it's on there. I loved it. I thought it was an interesting book, and I like interesting. I like books that make me think. So there you go.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'm certainly happy with it's turned out. I think Ryan's done fantastic work in the art with Doug and Colors as well, and I think it was a really cool book, and I'm excited for people to check it out.
Excellent, excellent. So we'll start at the top and work our way down, right? The first question is always the same question. What is it about comics that brought you into their fold, so to speak?
Well, as a reader or as a creator?
Both.
All right, okay. Probably two different answers. but as a reader, like, I've read comics ever since I was like a little kid, and back then it was the characters, all these larger than life kind of personalities and all these kind of great stories, and like people like me, there was like Batman or Spider-Man. I just love the idea of it's like you were discovering a secret world where because these characters had existed decades before you were alive, you know, you could kind of find this, you know, world that felt like it was secret and yours, and then like there was all these extra stories to discover from the past, and then there was more press stories coming in the future. I just loved that whole aspect of it. I loved the kind of like the heroes and the villains and the costumes and all that. And I just loved the whole serialized nature of comics. I know that's kind of maybe going away depending on who you ask, but I just love the whole idea of like reading a chapter of something and then like, there's a cliffhanger and you can come back a month to find out what happens next. I just think that's a really kind of cool aspect of comic storytelling. It's always kind of drawn me in, the whole idea of serialized narrative. Mm-hmm. In terms of as a creator, although I'd read comics for a long time, and I'd always wanted to be a writer of some kind, putting the two together like didn't happen right away. But once it did, what really appealed to me is the idea that there's no budget or limitations. Like, I did a little bit of writing for film back when I first graduated from university. That's what I did at university, film. And like with film, so much of like the process is coming up with this idea, then thinking, right, how can I strip this idea down and kind of tear it apart to make it something practical and doable. Yeah. And I love that that's not the case with comics. With comics, if you think of something, like, you can write it down, you can make it happen. I know, like, artists must hate that answer. Like, you know, oh, it's so easy just to write a massive cosmic battle with thousands of people, like, you know, and they're like, that takes me a week of my life to draw you, scumbag. But
unless you're George Perez, of course, and then it's like, a couple of hours.
But you know what I mean in terms of, like, you can tell any kind of story. Like, for someone like me who loves genre stories, who's always kind of appealed, like, you know, whether it's fantasy or horror or superheroes, like, I love kind of larger than life stories, and I feel that's why comics kind of tailors to kind of my writing sensibilities. And I just love the whole structure of it. I like that it's a challenge. I like the limitations of you only have this much real estate. You have 20 pages or 22 pages or 24 pages, and you only have a certain amount of space per page. And it's like, how do you try and like tell the story you want to tell within this kind of rigid structure, and how do you make it feel less rigid than it actually is? I love that whole challenge. And also, because comics is a relatively new medium, I feel like there's scope to still do new stuff in it and things that haven't been done before. I always do things that are unusual and fresh for this medium anyway. And that's really exciting as a creator. So that's why I like comics.
Cool, excellent. I'm with you on this, by the way. I have a load of friends who just buy graphic novels, like the trade paperbacks and stuff, and they go on like, why'd you buy floppies when you can just wait and get it all in one go? It's like, because I like the parts, man. I like reading and then putting it away. And, you know, that's why TV shows exist.
Yeah,
because, exactly. You know, it's not everything's going to be a 3-hour long movie. Sometimes I want to watch my, you know, I always go back and say something crazy like, do you remember Highlander, the TV show?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Highlander, the TV show, more than I like the movies, because the movies are set to that hour and a half and that's all you get out of it. Whereas the TV show gets 22 episodes of 40 minutes to tell the story.
Yeah, and it pisses it out. And for me, it's like, no one's saying you can't buy the graphic novel. When I have like a massive collection of graphic novels and absolute editions and what have you. But for example, the most striking example of that is Scalp. I have all 60 single issues, plus I have the 10 trades, plus I have the 5 hardcovers. But for me, that's like the TV analogy. It's like the graphic novels, like the box set, the DVD box set, you know, like, which is nice to have, and it's kind of a nice artifact to sit in your shelf. But like picking up a issue is like watching each week on TV, you know, and like having to find out what happens next in the water cooler conversations.
Cool. Excellent. It's a great metaphor. Great metaphor. You've talked about how art can challenge and how artists are going to hate you for doing all sorts of stuff. The current model that seems to be quite prevalent is the 9-panel page. How, as a writer, do you kind of work with that artist? Do you kind of give direction, saying, like, this is the kind of number of panels I want, this is kind of what I need, or do you sort of like give the script to the artist and let him just go wild and then see what comes back?
This would be a different answer depending on what writer you talk to. I know like a lot of writers who will just write the basics of a scene, like in this page someone enters a room and they have a conversation and then they have a drink, and then like they'll let the artist break down the panels. But for me, I tend to plot out the panels specifically, but I'll tend to write in a script.
Okay.
Like page 1, 6 panels, and I'll write down what happens in each panel. And for me, that kind of helps with, like, you know, having some kind of sense of the pacing and things as well. And I also think that by doing that, it's letting me have a better idea of what's possible. If I'm trying to kind of like write down, okay, this is the amount of panels in the page, I'm having to think critically of this is what needs to be done in this page, rather than just like leaving it to the artist and trying to let them figure it out, and maybe I'm writing something that's impossible. So if I'm kind of breaking it down, at least I'm kind of working through the process of figuring out how you would visualize this as well. So I like to kind of go into a bit more detail on my scripts.
Cool. Is that kind of a hangover from when you were at uni doing film studies then? You kind of got to have to look at that camera angle type thing.
Although in my earliest comic scripts, I did go quite regimented, but I would have like close up shot, medium shot, which I don't really do anymore. I kind of leave that more to the artist these days. But for me, I will say, though, it's more of a guideline than an absolute rigorous. I'm never someone that's going to say, right, this has to be 6 panels and it has to have this layout or else. For me, I think of it as a guideline. And Mountainhead is a prime example of that. Like, there's a lot of pages in that script which were like 4-panel pages, 5-panel pages. And Ryan came back with like 9 or 10 panels in the page when she's adding lots of extra touches and flourishes and things. So that for me, I think, is when a writer-artist partnership works really well, when like the script is a document that the artist can interpret and take in their own direction and do their own things with. And if you trust like the artist to do original things, like something I've said before, and it's a little bit of a cliche maybe, but the one thing that's even better than an artist giving you a page and it's exactly how you imagined it in your head is if an artist gives you back a page and it's somehow totally different than you imagined it in your head, but even better.
Yes. Excellent. So I can't imagine the feeling you get when you get the pages back and it's just checking to make sure how the surprise you get with some of the things that go on there. So I kind of tip my hat, definitely. You say genres, you like different genres. What's your favourite genre?
That's a tricky question, because like obviously I like stories in all genres, but I would have to say if I was to pick one, it would probably be horror. That's the one that I seem to drift back to the most, and I probably what I've most settled my reputation on thus far, at least. So yeah, probably I'd say if I was to pick one, it would be horror. But I do like all genres. I love a good romantic comedy as well.
Oh, see, I get grief for this. I say this a lot. I would rather go to the cinema and watch a rom-com than watch like a special effects laden movie. Because I think in a rom-com, at least you get two actors acting.
Yeah. For me, I think, like, you know, it's like anything. Like, there's good rom-coms and there's bad rom-coms. And a lot of folk have, like, the bad rom-com in mind and say, well, I don't like it. But, like, Groundhog Day is a rom-com. And I say one of the best, the cleverest movies ever.
All right, so which is the worst one, then? There you go. You've left yourself open for that one.
I honestly couldn't tell you what, because I'm sure, like, there's, like, some really, like, atrocious, like, direct-to-TV movies that I've watched and instantly punched from my brain because they were that terrible. But, like, for example, this is by no means, like, the absolute worst, because I'm sure it's a competently made movie, but Sweet Home Alabama, starring Reese Witherspoon, isn't necessarily the worst rom-com, but it's perhaps guilty of, like, the worst traits of a rom-com, which is, when the movie started, it was, like, 5 minutes in, and as an exercise, I opened up a Word document and I wrote, in this movie, this is going to happen, and I wrote beat by beat every single turn the plot is going to take. In this moment, this guy who you think is going to be the love interest is going to turn out to be a dick, and this guy who's acting really mean is going to turn out that secretly he's a nice guy, and gradually over the course of the movie, she's going to see he has a gentle side, but then there's going to be a manufactured conflict that's said 2/3 of the way through the movie that drives them apart, and she's going to be about to marry the other person, and she's going to run through the rain to this guy, and literally, like, beat by beat, that's exactly what happened, you know. And for me, like, there's nothing that's worse than a story than, actually, no, that's a lie. Sometimes a story can be predictable and it can be still enjoyable, but when, like, there's no room at all for kind of, like, surprises or anything, it's a bit of a dreary chore to watch, and that's when rom-com doesn't work too well.
Indeed. So how did you get into the comics? You've told me kind of what influence, like, you read comics as a kid and how you wanted to create books. How did you actually get broken into the field then? Because you've written indie books for lots of different small press, small press. Is IDW the biggest publisher you've worked with to date?
Yeah, I would say so. I did. So that's a kind of two-barrel question. I think, like, the first question would be, how did I get into making comics? The second question would be, how did I get working with IDW? Like, so the first part of that would be, in terms of making comics, I originally started doing comics, but as I said, I was fresh graduated out of uni on like a film studies thing, and I had a screenplay for a short film that was all ready to start adapting, and that kind of fell apart for various reasons, like a location fell through and yada yada. And so it was a bit of a loose end, and my friend Jamie, who is an artist, actually approached me and asked me if I would write a script for a comic for him to draw. Mm-hmm. And again, it was like a light bulb moment at this point, where I thought, well, I've always loved comics, but I've never thought of writing a comic. Would I want to write a comic? That could be quite fun. So I kind of researched kind of the modes of writing and formatting a comic script, and I decided just to kind of give it a go. And my friend Jamie, who has a kind of moody, kind of abstract kind of art style, lots of charcoals and stuff, had an idea of a kind of really kind of like low-key, psychological kind of noir comic possibly. So I went and I came up with a really bright, day-glow, cheery superhero comic instead. So, and that's where The Standard was born, and I kind of, which was a comic about a superhero from the 1960s who gets old, retires, comes a chemistry teacher, and he has to come out of retirement the present day to investigate the death of his former sidekick. And so Jamie read the script I wrote for that. I wrote the first issue in the course of like a week, and I had a mad rush of inspiration. And Jamie read the script and said, like, you know, one, this is great, and two, I can't draw it. So that kind of went in a draw for a while, and I kind of forgot about the idea. And then this was maybe early 2009. An editor called Stephen Forbes used to run an online column back when there used to be message boards. Can you remember that? And it was, and then the Project Fanboy message boards, and it was called The Proving Grounds. And Steve's a working editor, and he would do this thing where people would send in their scripts to him, and he would just kind of like tear them apart, like brutally, like Simon Cowell style, like, you know, give up comics and become an accountant. This is terrible. And I was thinking, well, it could be quite interesting to submit the standard one to Stephen, and see, even if it gets torn apart, I can just learn when I'm going wrong. It could be an educational experience. So I sent a message to Steve, and I sent the script in, And I was a long wait for a few weeks until it was my time in the block. And then when my script was in the proving grounds for the standard one, yeah, it had a couple of issues and he said, this is wrong, you should do this and this should be changed. But his overall response was actually positive. And he'd said at the end, in his little kind of afterword that he usually wrote in his columns, he's like, this is the first script that anybody's ever submitted to the proving grounds that after I finished like the 8-page excerpt that I was reviewing for the purposes of the column, I actually kept on reading because I wanted to find out what happened next. So he messaged me back, he messaged me privately afterwards and said he thinks this is a comic that could get made, and if he was interested, you know, he'd come on board as editor and we could develop the project together. So that's what he did. We ended up developing it as a 6-issue miniseries, and I wrote the scripts and he helped me find an artist and went through it and kind of handheld me through the whole process of making my first comic. And then by the time it was finally finished in terms of the scripting, Stephen was like, well, we could either go through the process of pitching to publishers, you know, and I'll happy to kind of help you through that if you want. Or the other option would be like my friend Tyler, Tyler James, is actually going to be launching a new imprint called Comics Tribe. It's kind of new indie label, and they're looking for an opening lineup of books. And, you know, he's checked out the standard, the scripts, and he thinks it's amazing. Like, can he be willing to kind of like just say, come on board for this? So I thought, yeah, I could try and, like, you know, pitch around to bigger publishers and what have you, but I was an unknown creator with no credits to my name at this point, so it would be a long shot, and I could spend, like, a year doing that to no avail, so why not try and get in the ground floor with a smaller publisher? And I've been, my relationship with Comics Tribe has lasted with for, like, the decade since then, and they're the guys who published Then When It's Gone, they published Oxymoron, they published Sync, so it's been a really fruitful relationship, and then the rest is history from there. As for the IDW part, I actually did a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles universe story for them. That was through Nick Patara, the artist of Manhattan Projects and Leviathan for Image Comics, and he's doing, I think, a Doom Patrol thing for DC right now. I kind of became friendly with Nick through he'd been a fan of some of the art. I think I'd shared him in a top 10 comics list at one point, and through that he became friends with Ian Laurie, who's a Scottish artist, and they kind of, so he was very, Nick was very supportive of our project and Emily was gone, we kind of kept in touch, and we're supposed to be doing an anthology short together for something at one point, which fell through, and Nick had always said we'll work on something else together at some point. So the IDW had approached Nick about doing a Turtles one shot. I think he wanted them to write and draw it, and he said he was interested in doing it, but if he was going to do it, he wanted to work with John Lees, and he probably said, who the hell's John Lees? but they kind of, like, they said, well, all right, okay, like, let John pitch some ideas and we'll see if they're interested. So I pitched an idea of reviving this old obscure villain from the toy line called Worm, who was this kind of flatworm, and he was deemed too scary to be transferred over into the cartoon, so he's never used in the cartoon. I wanted to bring him back and have me and Nick do our version of him, who was going to be even scarier. Like, rather than one flatworm, he was lots of little flatworms who came together to form this, like, one massive thing. So I think we wrote what was probably together among between us, we kind of wrote and created, which I think was quite probably the scariest Teenage Ninja Turtles comic that's ever existed. And, like, IDW were really pleased with it, and Bobby Curnow, the editor, said, like, you know, the door's always open if you want to pitch anything else. So when it came time to, we were looking around for people to shop Mountainhead to, me and Ryan, I thought, why not approach IDW? And IDW were really keen on the idea and liked the story, and we kind of backed and forth for a little while. And one thing which I really appreciate and really respect about Bobby and the editors at IDW was the initial pitch we sent them, they came back to us and said, we like the idea, but we're not sure if the kind of pitch pages that you've chosen kind of best showcase the series. Would you be willing to try and do, like, another scene or something else, and kind of back and forth with us? A lot of publishers wouldn't do that. A lot of publishers would have just said no right off the bat. So I like the idea that, like, Bobby, even if the pitch wasn't necessarily what he was looking for, they had an open enough mind that they wanted to keep the contact open, which was really appreciated. And the IDW have been great to work with ever since, and I'm really pleased to be part of IDW's little resurgence of quality titles like Road of Bones and Kanto and Ghost Tree.
I think IDW have kind of, I think they cross the bridge between tie-in books and create your own stuff that I think they work really well. They don't kind of focus just on one element, which is a good thing. Where were we at?
Yeah, sorry, I was talking so long. You probably
That's fine. No, it's great. And do you know what? People listen to the show to hear you talk, not to hear me talk. They may talk on other things, but you know, it's cool.
Okay, understand of me talking. That's correct.
Before we move on to the book per se, what is it with the proliferation of Scottish writers? You've got yourself, you've got Mark Miller, you've got Grant Morrison. What is it about you Scots that can just knock out great comic book stories?
I think it's a clean drinking water.
What? I've been in Scotland. There's no clean drinking water up there.
In Scotland, and it's like fresh and clean, and there's obviously nutrients in the water that kind of like fires up with creative inspiration.
That's called whiskey. We have
that. I'm actually, I don't drink, so I can't even use that.
All right, okay. So, Mountain Head. This is your book. It's due out in August. It's a 5-issue miniseries, correct?
It is, yeah.
It is. Excellent. Talk us through it. What was the inspiration, first of all? We'll start at the start. What was your inspiration for the book that kind of made you think, what if?
Well, it's actually, Mountainhead has had an interesting kind of long, multi-pronged road to kind of coming to life. Like, the first stage of that was, before I came up with Mountainhead, or the larger premise of the story, before I had anything else, I had the character, Abraham Stubbs, right down to his name. Mm-hmm. And I had this idea of Abraham Stubbs and his father Noah wandering mm-hmm. through the wilderness, living off the grid, and the idea of this kid who, for his whole life, for as long as he can remember at least, has been on the run and looking over his shoulder, and his dad is convinced that there's shady government forces looking for them, and that they have to kind of stay under the radar, because if they're caught, they'll be indoctrinated and brainwashed, so they have to kind of burgle houses for a living. That was a kind of premise for an idea that I had in my head for some time, right down to kind of like the developments that happen over the course of the story, and like the way that Abraham's life is kind of upended. That was all kind of developed as a kind of like concept in my head, drawn from a couple of quite dramatic real life stories, which I can't really go into specifically until people have read the book. But after issue one's came out, I can tell a little bit about the real life inspirations, which had a kind of big impact on me. Okay. But yeah,
so when the series done, you can come back on and say, it was that. It was that one.
After issue one's came out, I'll do the kind of the whole thing. This is what I was talking about. But yeah, it was a couple of real life stories, a couple of dramatic real life stories that had a big impact on me, who Abraham Stubbs kind of draws from. Mm-hmm. And so I had this character in my head who was really fully realised, and there's like kind of like a life in my brain, but then I didn't have a story for him. I had the kind of initial setup, I had the premise, I had the inciting incident, and then I just had nothing. I had like, or any ideas for stories that I came up with felt really kind of perfunctory and not as good, or didn't live up to the character that I had. So I was ended up being kind of like unsatisfied, and Abraham went on the shelf in the kind of ideas, the inactive ideas pile in my head that I keep archived, and then they stayed there for a little while. And then fast forward a little while later, at some point in 2016, I met Ryan Lee for the first time at C2E2 in Chicago. We'd known each other for a few years online. I'd been a big fan of his work. I loved his kind of really distinctive designs. I think that Ryan is one of the most distinctive voices in comics. When you look at his designs, he has these sketchbooks he sells at shows. They're called, I think it's called Monsterology or something, where he designs creatures and monsters and stuff. And it's just his line work and his level of grisly detail just drew me in. And what I found really fascinating was then you'd see his commissions and he'd do like superhero sketches and stuff on Twitter. And he brings that weird monstery quality to regular people and makes really unusual anatomy and kind of make it's not quite like anything else you've seen. And I thought, this guy's a really interesting artist. And I thought for some time I'd love to kind of do a book with this guy that just really showcased like what's special about his art and kind of like just have a book that's kind of celebration of that kind of visuals. And unbeknownst to me, while I was sitting here thinking like, how am I going to approach Ryan Lee about doing a project together, he'd been thinking the same thing about me. So when we met at C2E2, he actually pitched me. He said, I'd love for you to come up with a story for me to draw. and this was a first for me. I've approached artists, and I've had like me and an artist kind of like start off the bat together, thinking let's develop something together. Mm-hmm. I've never had something that was artist driven with an artist who came to me and said write a story for me. So it was mm-hmm. quite daunting. And I developed this idea called Mountainhead, which had the setting of the small town of Brayrick at the foot of the Rocky Mountains in Canada, and this kind of really kind of like creepy paranoid atmosphere, and like the visuals and the aesthetics of flashes of red blood in the snow, mm-hmm. and the opening scene of Mountainhead one, you know, where the guy's like staggering off the mountain, and like there's like, you know, a scene of carnage in his wake. Uh-huh. That was all kind of in Mountainhead, but I had a different problem with Mountainhead than I had with my earlier idea, which is I had a really distinctive, clear sense of plot and aesthetic and what I wanted to do and how Ryan would be a great fit for it. But the story felt hollow because I had no characters that were really compelling. Mm. So I had a plot without characters. Then I remembered I had a character without a plot. And I put it together and it ended up weird feeling like they both kind of completed each other. We both had felt incomplete, put them together, one enriched the other and kind of like played off the other in unusual ways. And that's how what became Mountainhead was born.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So yeah, when I was reviewing the book, I did some research looking at Ryan Lee's work, and I totally agree with you. There's the superhero stuff, and you think, yeah, it's superhero stuff, you know. And then you turn the page, it's like monsters and it's gory. It's like I look at it and I think, how can somebody who's drawn sometimes really clean lines for Superman then go all elbows and knees? Because I think one of the distinctive designs in Mountainhead is Abraham himself, because he is gangly. He's got like that oversized head, that Damien head, shall we say. And then he's got like his elbows are all at wonky angles. It's kind of like a mini scarecrow type thing. He's got bloody knees and stuff. And I think the design is just, it's unusual because you don't expect it. But once you're submerged in the book, it fits perfectly.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what I love about his character designs is when you look at Mountainhead in particular, there's not one character in that book that looks comfortable in their own skin. And that kind of discomfort then transfers across to the reader and kind of immerses them in that kind of uneasy atmosphere. Yeah. And yeah, I think for me, like, yes, I'm quite proud of the story I've put together, but what really elevates this book is it just looks, you know, incredible. And like, Ryan's done a fantastic job. And like, every page is like a tapestry. I think he's just done a fantastic job.
I totally agree. I think I don't want to use this word that much because I don't want to play anybody off, but the emotional elements on this of the art are surprising when you see how quirky it can be at times. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely, that makes sense. And I appreciate that in the review that you wrote, that yes, there's like visual innovation and there's unusual layouts and there's kind of like quirky designs, like you say, but there's a real heart to it all as well. Yeah. And like, you can kind of get the pain in characters' eyes, is when that's like what some of the strongest stuff in the book is.
Definitely. There's like a whole different mix of styles. So you've got the elements we've talked about, but then as you get further into the book, there's like big eyes and big expressive faces with a touch of a manga feeler to it. I was just really blown away by it, to be fair.
I mean, for me, like, one of the kind of touch points that I had in my mind, like, and I think I talked to Ryan about it as well, as a book that, you know, I thought was really effective, was, I'm not sure if you've ever read it, but House of Penance.
I've not read it.
Yeah, and Ian Bertram is the artist on that. And that is a set, like, ostensibly, it's a ghost story. It's about the Winchester House. And like, you know, the kind of like the Winchester widow who, like, was always kind of, you know, building construction and stuff, doing building like dead alleys in this big massive like never-ending mansion under construction to try and like lure the ghosts and kind of misdirect the ghosts who she was convinced were haunting the place, like the ghosts of everyone that was killed by a Winchester rifle. And so it's a five or six issues, and you barely see, like, there's like no ghosts at all in it. It's all just like facial expressions and sweaty mm-hmm. faces and bulging eyes, and the kind of oppression and the kind of emotional kind of like crescendo that's built up through that puts you in the edge of your seat in a way that no amount of, like, you know, gore or monsters could possibly match.
Cool. The intimation carries your imagination.
Yeah.
Cool. I want to talk a little bit about the colours. Colours are by, Let me get back to the credits page.
Doug Garbark.
Well done. Points for
and that was actually a point of contention for me because if you've looked at the credits, it's written by me, John Lees. It is drawn by Ryan Lee, and it is lettered by Sean Lee. And so when
there's a lot of Lees going on in this book, I tell you. Yes, does Stan Lee have anything to do with it?
Yes, I'm you know, like I'm Jim Lee's son. when Ryan came to me and said, "Have you got any notes about what you'd like from the colorist?" And I was like, "Could their surname be either Lee or Lees, just to kind of like to keep the kind of consistency?" I wanted. I was thinking, could we maybe call like Doug brackets Lee Garbark, and then we could just say that's. But sadly, no. So like Garbark, apart from like. Is so rudely ruining the lovely visual alignment of the page. Other than that, everything he's brought to the book has been a net positive. Ryan is the first person that will tell you that he's a hard person to colour because his work is so highly rendered and so detailed and meticulous that a lot of colouring or attempts to colour his work mutes a lot of the detail. So he's found the perfect partner in Doug who is able to kind of enhance those details and bring them out and actually make it feel more immersive. So I'm really pleased with what Doug's brought to the book and how he works with Ryan.
Excellent. I agree. The colours are fantastic. I know digital colouring's an art in itself, so I always try and give nods to colourists. Talking of nods, you mentioned that Sean Lee's letters. The letters have an unusual font all the way through. They're kind of like an almost handwritten font. Is that something that you kind of asked for, or did you?
I didn't ask for anything like that specifically, but I did tell Sean that I wanted him to feel comfortable in bringing his own voice and his own kind of innovation to the proceedings, and kind of be an author as well, because a writer is part of the creative team, and so I wanted him to feel kind of like emboldened to experiment and try new things, and he has, and he's done really well with it. I think he's done some fantastic work too. Sean is actually a really talented letterer. He is the I think he's the in-house letterer who does a lot of stuff for IDW. I've worked with him on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which he did a great job on. And so I'd said to him, do they want to do the lettering on sync? And I assumed he'd be super busy, but he's like, no, I don't actually do a lot of like other lettering outside of like the kind of house gigs, which surprised me because he's so good and he's like so professional. And so, yeah, now like Sean like works with me in just about everything. He works with me on sync. He's worked with me on Deep Ender, which is my kind of comedy book that I do, and now he's working with me on Mountainhead, and it also helps that he's Ryan Lee's brother, so like you know, they have that
I assumed, but I didn't want to make that so
I've met both Ryan and Sean at conventions, and like they're a pair of lovely boys. Obviously the Lee family raised their kids right. I'm just a pair of gents. And I think he's done a fantastic job, and I think like he definitely brings his own voice to proceedings, and like the fonts and the kind of style is definitely one of the things that makes the book distinctive.
I think a lot of letterers work for studios. I can't pick up a Marvel book without them saying it's VC's Travis Lanham.
Yeah, I have noticed that.
And you're like, oh, who's VC? You know, I mean, well, I mean, Terry Esposito is an absolute legend who's been promoting letterers getting credits for quite a while now. And it's thanks to him that I give credits to letterers. I never used to. I used to think, oh, yeah, they're just letterers. But all my reviews now have something to say about the lettering, always.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like I say, letterers do a fantastic job. Yeah. And enhance the books. And for me, like, with sync, Sean is on like the cover. I can credit him because I think like he's an important part of the book. I don't think Sean's actually on the cover for Mountainhead, but I that wasn't down to me. I wanted to put him on the book, but Sean himself said, I'd rather not be on like the book.
Lee's Lee, Garbuck and Lee.
Is that modest? He's like, no, I don't want to. I'd feel awkward putting myself in. Like, you should put yourself in there, Sean. Yeah. You're doing fantastic work.
I've called a couple of people out recently, a little bit off topic, but DC Comics don't credit the colorist and the letterer for Doomsday Clock.
Yeah, no, that for me, and I know it's something, and also it comes from a well-intentioned place. Sometimes you'll see people on Twitter or on Facebook, or and they'll go, "I just read," I'm not saying Mountainhead, they'll go, "I read Mountainhead, and John and Ryan did a fantastic job."
Yeah.
And I try not to be a dick about it. I don't want to come back and say, "Well, you forgot the colorist in the letter," but I always kind of like reply back and say, "Thank you," and Doug and Sean did a fantastic job as well, and I make sure to tag the two of them just so they're getting the praise too.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We kind of, you know, we give letters where we give credit where credit's due, because the comic experience, it's not just the plot, it's not just the art, it's the whole aesthetic, as you said. You know, the fact that the colours in this book, they go through some strange places right from the outset, then all the way through, and then you end up in an even weirder place. And he's just kind of, you know, Doug's kept that quality all the way through. There's no bit that you don't feel part of that book, which I think is a great thing. So there you go. Cool. So let's talk. Are you a bit of a takeover, Ted, when it comes to your work? Is the collaboration between all of you really truly collaboration?
No, absolutely. I like to try and make sure like everyone feels involved in the process. I'm not someone that tries to be too micromanagey, or like say like I think that generally speaking, like if there's something that's like really major and I say this has to be there for plot reasons, then like yes, I'll say like, can you put this in? But generally speaking, if an artist will come back with a page and it's different from how I imagined it, I'll try to like, you know, like encourage that, and like, because most of the time, yes, because it actually does enhance the page and it's better, because the artists know what they're doing with visual storytelling. But even in times when like something's came in and it's been like a little bit different, I thought, oh, I don't know if I would have done that. I think like you say, like comics is a partnership, and for me, something you have to think is, if an artist, like, you know, has felt, well, I want to try and kind of bring something in here and kind of add my own voice to this and kind of like express myself a little bit, like, is it really worth it, you know, like stamping that out and going, no, don't do what I say, Art Monkey, you know, like, and so for me, you know, I think I'm sure like there's been times and I've kind of like, and I'm sure many an artist has groaned at my like intense level of detail in my scripts, but when it comes to the actual process of collaboration, I try to kind of be open about it and like encourage the rest of the creative team to bring their own touches and their own flourishes to proceedings.
Cool. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask which is more important right now, because that's just a whole bag of crazy that I just want to
it seems to emerge like maybe like two or three times every year, and I'm not sure if like, you know, like how into like, you know, if you follow like wrestling at all, but like as an analogy I bring out, if I could find a gif of like there was a moment in a wrestling match like last year when like two wrestlers, AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura, run to each other and they both went to kick each other in the nuts, and they kicked each other in the nuts at the same time and they both fell over. And for me, like that like embodies like the writer versus artist debate in a nutshell, like, you know.
The most recent wrestling I've seen is where some guy was saying in the ring, there's a guy at work that's really into it, so I tend to try and keep up a little bit so I can have a conversation with the guy, because I'm a nice guy like that. And some guy was saying, there's no man alive that could take me, no man alive. And of course, the lights go out, the lights come up, and there's the Undertaker. And I'm like, oh, look, there's the Undertaker. He's back.
I'm the intellectual who's like, no, yes, Undertaker's past his prime, blah blah blah. And then like I went to WrestleMania this year, like, you know, and I was squealing like a kid like anybody else when the lights went off. So
gutted when the streak ended.
Yeah.
Proper gutted. So who are your inspirations at the moment? Who kind of do you read or look at and you think, wow?
Myself. Wow, that guy's great. Talented and handsome. No. For me, it changes all the time. Like, you know, in terms of like comics creators, like I think there's like so many people doing interesting stuff. And yes, I could give the examples of like, you know, some of my favorite creators, like guys like, you know, Grant Morrison or Jason Aaron. But for me, what really motivates me and like what people really energizes me is when I see like my friends doing awesome, exciting stuff. Like, I'm in a writing group with It's me, Rich Duick, Kenny Porter, who's a talented writer, and Fraser Campbell, who's another writer based out of Scotland. And I see some of the stuff they're doing right now. Like, Rich just did Road of Bones. And for me, like, Rich has been a really talented writer that's been doing stuff, you know, for years now. Like, he did Gutter Magic, which was really good, and he did Wailing Blade, which is fantastic.
I love Wailing Blade. I've reviewed that book as well. That's great.
Yeah, no, it's such a good book, and Joe Mulvey's great in it. But, like, I saw Road of Bones, and that came out, and as good as all his other stuff, you see Road of Bones, and you think, oh, this is something special. This is, like, Rich taking it to another level, and he's really kind of raising the bar, and this is going to be such a great, successful book for him. And it really kind of energises you seeing your friends doing well. And I've seen, like, Fraser Campbell, because I get to see this stuff before anybody else, because I get to see the scripts, because we're in a writing group. He's written a comic called House of Sweets. It's a graphic novel, which is getting drawn by Ian Laurie. And for me, as someone who's been, like, chasing how to make, like, a proper scary horror comic, I've been doing this for the best part of a decade. I've been kind of, like, trying to kind of, you know, study the medium and figure out how I can use the medium to frighten people. And I've tried things like An Emily Was Gone and some issues of Sync. I've tried to push the boundaries a little bit. And so for me, that's something of an obsession for me. So I saw Fraser on his first attempt. This book, House of Sweets, is scarier than anything I've ever written, and it's, like, one of the best scripts I've ever read. And it's one of these things that almost makes you angry. You're annoyed that someone can be this good at that. I'm jealous, but
at the same home run.
But at the same time, like, I'm really excited. I'm so excited to see this come out, and, like, I know some of the stuff, like, Kenny's got coming out. It's not been announced yet, but it's going to be really exciting. People hear about it and seeing him getting, like, little gigs, like, doing, like, you know, backups for DC anthologies and things, and, like, it's just really exciting seeing your friends and peers do well, and that really motivates you to think, like, no, well, you know, we're part of, like, a community together, and we're kind of, you know, we're maybe raising each other up, and we're seeing each other succeed, and that for me is what really motivates me, I think.
Cool. Back in the day, Vertigo was the source for DC for everything that was a little bit off the wall, a little bit scary, a little bit mature, and I'm talking about proper mature, not Batman naked mature.
That's the Batcock.
Yeah, man. Do you know how much the Batcock's worth?
I don't know. It must be obscene prices by now.
No, I sold mine for £43.
Oh, wow.
So, and I'll tell you the story dead quickly. I got to read Damn 3 for review, yeah. And I hated it. I was like, I've wasted all this money on these three books, and this, and basically it's that's the story, really. I was so angry. I ran my comic book shop now. Because even though I get to review comics, people might not realize I still go out and buy the damn things. Because yeah. If I don't buy them, there's going to be no comics. So it's like self-fulfilling, right? Yeah. So I rang them up and said, I do not want Batman Damn number 3. Do not put it in my order. Thank you very much. Hung up. And then I thought, oh, what am I going to do with it? Issue 1 and 2? Because, you know, whatever. Yeah. So I'll check on eBay what they're going for. One of them sold for £77. I was like, really? And then when I did some proper digging, the average price is between 36 and 45. So I was like, well, you know what? Boof, off they went. So I've got £43 sitting in my PayPal waiting to spend on more comic books.
There you go. You've got Bruce Wayne Schlong to thank.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. The wrong sort of dick. Never mind. So with Vertigo closing, do you feel that that's an avenue that DC are going to potentially lose the kind of writers such as yourself who are potentially more into doing the horror and the little bit off the wall storylines rather than straight up superhero stuff?
I don't know. I mean, like, obviously, like, if you think about it, like, Swamp Thing, when that first came out with Alan Moore and Stephen Bissett, John Totleben, that was a DC mainline book when that came out. Vertigo came later, like, you know, and yeah. DC has had, like, you know, its share of kind of off-the-wall stuff, so I'm sure there will still be an avenue somewhere for those books to exist. And the good thing is, I mean, like, I loved Vertigo. Like, for me, like, some of, like, my all-time favourite comics are Vertigo books, and, like, getting to do a Vertigo comic was always one of those bucket list things that I wanted to do. But the good thing is that, like you mentioned, back in the day, Vertigo was, like, the one place essentially you could go to tell those kind of stories, but there's more publishers than ever around now. Like, you know, there's lots of publishers that are kind of, like, carrying that torch of Vertigo. Literally, the editors who ran Vertigo are off doing other books, like Burger Books for Dark Horse, and Shelley Bond's doing the Black Crown label in IDW. So, like, the spirit of Vertigo, and Will Dennis, he's freelance editing books for Image. So, the spirit of Vertigo lives on, like, across the comics world. So
definitely, the Burger Books are brilliant. Yeah. I have not read a bad Burger Book yet.
Yeah. So, one of my great comics regrets was Karen Berger was moderating a Vertigo panel at one of the first New York Comic Cons I went to, and I was too intimidated to go up and like say hello to her. There was nobody there to, you know, like talking to her after the panel. They all rushed to talk to like the creators instead. I had an opportunity, and I was like, no, I don't want to bother. And I kind of wish that I'd actually went and said, like, you know,
Well, that's your story, isn't it? With, you want to go work with an artist, and he wants to work with you. My day job, I help people, and I say in the good interviews and stuff, I say, don't be put off by the guy sat next to you. You think they look good? They're probably thinking you look good. You just don't know. You don't know what's going on. You know, yeah. So you know, just be yourself. Go for it. And you're absolutely right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of different avenues now. Back in the day, it was Vertigo or bust. Now there's IDW, which are doing a great run. You've got Image, who, interestingly, quick question, with The Walking Dead finishing recently, how do you think they're going to fare? Do you think they'll feel the hit of the loss of The Walking Dead? Because that was like a top 10 book every month, wasn't it?
Well, I think they'll absolutely feel the loss of The Walking Dead, because, like, how could you not feel the loss of something that was such a monumental, massive hit? But, like, for one, The Walking Dead back catalogue is always going to be there, and it's going to be a perennial seller for Image from now through to Kingdom Come. But on top of that, like I say, there's like, well, I'm sure there's like that kind of like drops the gauntlet, like what other books are going to come out to kind of like fill the void left by The Walking Dead, and there's going to be new stuff kind of coming out. So I'm sure Image will continue to do well, and it'll kind of like this will kind of push them to see like what's going to be their next big story.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, cool. Thinking about yourself and your particular love of different genres, could you see yourself working on a big two book? Is that kind of like on your bucket list, or are you happy staying away from the multimedia icons where you can't do a great deal with and you can do your own creative stuff?
No, I think, like, you know, I would absolutely be interested in like doing a big two book at some point. Obviously, for me, I always want to be telling my own stories in one fashion or another, so I would never want to kind of like abandon that for big two. But yeah, I do think there's a certain appeal in, like, I love the idea of contributing to like this big tapestry of like this world that's like been there like since before you were born, is going to keep on being there after you're gone. I love the idea of kind of like putting your, like, you know, it's like stitching something into like the quilt, you know, like
adding
a little bit to it. And I like the idea of doing that, and I love the idea of like kind of playing with these kind of iconic characters. And I had a little bit of that with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I love Turtles as a kid, but I never had as long or just enduring a love affair with them as I did with like certain superheroes. But even so, like when I was writing scenes like with Michelangelo, it was like you were a kid again, and you were playing like with your action figures, and you were like coming up with elaborate storylines with these people, kind of tapped into that inner child kind of feeling. And I imagine it'd be kind of like really exciting to do something similar for, like, you know, like iconic characters from Marvel or DC at some point. And I'd also love to kind of like, what I'd love to do would be, if I could, would be to tell a story with those characters which still felt like one of my stories. Because what I'm quite proud of is I did a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic, which very much felt like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic from the writer of An Emily Was Gone in Sync. And I would love to kind of maybe do something similar with, like, you know, a Marvel or DC character.
I could see you on Constantine.
Yeah, or just something like, you know, like, how could I do this character, like, in a tap into in a way that's kind of weird or scary or creepy? Like, for example, it's funny because, like, Immortal Hulk, like, I simultaneously love that book. It was my favourite book of last year, and I'm kind of angry at it, because, like, my idea for years was always, like, you know, what if you do The Hulk, but it's, like, a proper horror book, you know? and now you and me do it.
I've seen this week's issue with the Immortal Hulk, and I felt it was a little bit lacking. I thought they've explained too much, and I was like, oh man, you've spoiled the magic now.
But, it can do no wrong. I'm still very much on the hook.
Everybody loves it. Everybody I speak to loves that book. So, you know, I'm just one guy. What can I say?
Well, yeah, one I could man definitely fighting against the world,
fighting against the immortal Hulk. No, I'm not. I'm joking. I think it's an interesting premise. I think, did I read somewhere that it's going to come to an end soon? So I think Marvel are kind of getting out while they're getting good on that one.
Honestly, I'm not sure. I'm sure, you don't know what the rumor mill is, and like, you know, like you try and buy a pinch of salt, but I'm sure I heard at some point the plan was to like end Immortal Hulk, then relaunch it just as the Hulk with like the same creative team or something.
Well, it's Marvel, so you know, Marvel, like, you know.
Yeah.
One book cancels, another two take its place. It's like Hydra.
Yeah. As long as those guys are kept in work, I'll be happy definitely, because they're a good team.
I'll give you that, definitely. But I could definitely see you on a Constantine book, something that's a little bit obviously horror. I'd like to see, like, I personally would like to see a serious Satana book. Satana.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I kind of think she's seen as the cheesecake magician, but I think actually there's quite a lot of darkness in her, so I'd like to see that kind of explored from my own personal taste. So,
I love all those DC kind of horror characters. That's one of my favorite corners of the DC universe. Just like those characters, like Swamp Thing or Etrigan the Demon or Deadman. I just love all those people.
We love the Demon so much. My wife, who doesn't read comics, knows the Etrigan rhyme.
Good. That was your wedding vows.
Yeah. I'll be like, what? I'm not a demon. She's like, oh, yeah, whatever. We'll see you later after the whiskeys. All right, okay, cool. that's great. So, finally, let's say that final orders for Mountain Head number one are July the 22nd. All right? Yes. So when you've listened to this pod, you will still have time to call your local comic book shop and get it ordered. All right? It's going to be in shops August the 14th.
Yes, please, like, do reach out to your retailer. Like, I know, like, for me, I fall into the habit as well, but it's easy to just, like, see a book that's interesting and go, oh, yeah, I'm sure that'll be in my comic shop, but you don't know if it'll be in your comic shop. And for me, as somebody, like, who has a lot of, like, friends who aren't necessarily into comics, like, I've had something where a book will come out, and on the week of its release, they'll message me and go, like, hi, John, how did I go about getting this book in my shops? And I'm like, first you have to build a time machine and go back, like, you know, a month ago, and like, you know, and get them to get it into your shop. Please, like, it really makes such a difference. Like, if you can, like, just say, ask your local retailer, hey, are you getting this book in? And it can make a world of difference. Like, especially with, like, us small guys in the indies, like, you know, every shop that supports us makes a difference. So, one, please do let your shops know. And two, like, if your shop is stocking it, let us know who they are so we can thank them, because we really appreciate, like, all shops that take a risk on indie books.
So, it's an IDW book. IDW are fantastic at getting their books out on schedule. All right. This isn't a doomsday clock that's gone on for like way too long. All right. This is a five issue series. First issue will be in the store August 14th. If your retailer goes, what? What are you talking about? The order code for the book is June. That's Juliet Uniform November. 190728. All right.
Yeah.
You can pause the pod for 2 seconds as you go and write that down. We'll still be here. We're not going to stop talking. You can pause it. You know, technology and all that, right? Yeah. So, last thoughts. Last comments on your fantastic new book, Mountain Head, that's due out in August. What would you like to say about it to entice the readers?
Well, what I would like to say is that whatever you think you know about the book, it's going to take you by surprise. It's a comic that's going to like pull the rug out from under your feet multiple times, not just in issue one. So expect the unexpected when you go into this book. And what I would say is go in knowing as little as possible. And that's not necessarily like the best way to pitch a book. But I would say if you can, avoid as much about the plot beforehand as you can. Try and go in fresh. This is going to be a book that's going to shock you. It's going to leave you on edge, and that's exactly how I like it. So please check it out. And also, in addition to Mountain Head, I should also point out that in this month's previews, in July previews, Sync Volume 2, the second volume of my comic series, is also available for pre-order. And we've also got Volume 1 resolicited as well. So if you're interested in catching up in that, look into doing that too.
There you go. Feel free to check out the advanced review of Mountain Head 1 on Comic Crusaders. It is spoiler free, so you've got that. And all left for me to say is thank you to John for taking the time out to speak to me today. John, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It was really fun chatting to you about Sweet Home Alabama.
I didn't say what my favourite rom-com is, so I'm not it's Love Actually, but I'm just all right, don't forget to check out the rest of the UCPN for all your favourite shows, including the Definitive Crusade and No Prize podcast, as well as the award-winning Flipside Focus. This is Johnny the Machine Hughes saying adios.
Visit UndercoverCapes.com for the latest and greatest podcasts via the Undercover Capes Podcast Network. Also visit our parent company website, ComicCrusaders.com, all about comic pop culture.